You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of October 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes.
We'll be setting the day's news agenda with Dr. James Boyce from King's College London. James, what are we looking at today?
Well, this morning we've got discussions about government shutdowns in the United States, US military raids in Africa, and Bibi Netanyahu warns about Iranian nuclear weapons.
Thanks, James. And at least 50 dying clashes between the police and pro-Morsi supporters in Egypt. We'll be on the line with our Cairo correspondent for the latest.
Plus, we'll be discussing the career of the man known as the non-flying Dutchman, Dennis Bergkamp.
What's interesting about Dennis is that the way he did it, his process of change. So, for example, the way he learned to control a football and do really interesting things with a football.
All that, plus we'll check in with our man in Madrid, we'll leaf through the Brazilian front pages, and we'll play you some great music too. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So a very busy Monday edition of the programme, but before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. At least six people, including four police officers, have been killed in a bomb attack which targeted anti-polio campaigners in Pakistan. The victims were travelling in a van which was part of an anti-polio campaign in the northwestern city of Peshawar. Polio remains endemic in Pakistan, where militants have banned vaccination teams in some areas. In previous attacks, they've killed health workers who were vaccinating children against the disease. At least 50 people have been killed in violent clashes between Egyptian security forces and supporters of the ousted President Mohamed Morsi. Most of the deaths were in Cairo, where 200 members of the Muslim Brotherhood were arrested. Hundreds of supporters had tried to march on Tahrir Square, where a large crowd had gathered to mark the 40th anniversary of the 1973 Arab-Israeli War. Secretary of State John Kerry says the United States and Russia have agreed to press the United Nations to set a date for a Syria peace conference sometime in the second week of November. Mr. Kerry made the announcement at a joint press conference with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov after they met for talks on the fringes of the APEC forum in Bali. He also had some praise for Damascus for its compliance with the UN Security Council resolution over Syria's chemical weapons.
I think it's also credit to the Assad regime for complying rapidly, as they are supposed to. Now, we hope that will continue. I'm not going to vouch today for what happens months down the road, but it's a good beginning, and we should welcome a good beginning.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew has warned that the ongoing government shutdown is harming the economy. Mr. Lew said politics in Washington could seriously damage the country's economic recovery unless the situation's resolved quickly.
You know, every day that the government is shut down, it does real harm to the American people. And I think you have to take a step back and look at where we are as a country, as an economy. The American people have been fighting their way out of the worst recession since the Great Depression. The economy is coming back. They don't need politics in Washington to bring the economy down.
Greek and international anti-fascist activists have attended a memorial rally for the left-wing rapper stabbed to death by a supporter of the far-right Golden Dawn Party. They say they want the far-right party leader and other members to stay in jail for justice to be served. Hundreds of anti-fascist protesters from across Europe, as well as local supporters, closed off the Athens street where Pavlos Fissas was stabbed to death last month. Wayman Bennett, the secretary of Britain's Unite Against Fascism organisation, was among those attending.
Pavlos came and played and supported us when we faced the British National Party, which is the sister organisation of Golden Dawn. When they were growing in Britain, we had a big music festival and he came and supported us. So I'm very sad to be here. They tried to murder our movement, and they murdered a great man.
Airbus has announced its first jet order from Japan Airlines. The $9.5 billion landmark deal for 31 wide-body A350 jets follows an intense battle with Boeing, as Japan's two top carriers seek dozens of new long-haul planes over the next decade. The agreement includes options for another 25 A350s, bringing the potential size to 56 aircraft. Boeing and Airbus are still battling for a similar order from ANA, which is looking for around 25 new jets to replace its aging fleet of long-haul Boeing 777s from 2020. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Barney, thank you very much indeed. The time is just after 5 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24. Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London,
Londres. Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai a Monocle, vada a City Chase.
From London,
London, London,
Caracas.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. The time is 6 minutes past the hour. It's time now for us to set the day's agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us today in the studio is Dr. James Boyes from King's College London. Welcome to the program, James. Shall we begin with the twin dramatic commando-style raids across the African continent?
Why ever not? Why ever not? fair enough. There's no doubt that we're seeing an interesting shift, I think, in US policy. For, let's say, most of the George W. Bush era and the first term of Barack Obama's term in office, the key weapon of choice was drones, of course. And we've spoken a lot about that on this program in the past. But I think what's fascinating now is that perhaps you're seeing a discernible shift in the second term. Even though there's been a development of drone bases across North Africa, when you've seen an attempt this weekend, both in Somalia and Libya, to go in, to put troops on the ground, do a snatch raid effectively, one wonders whether there's been a shift away from the drone technology towards a more sort of Clinton-era attempt to go in, get these people, bring them back and put them on trial, perhaps, and whether that's a sop to new individuals in the administration, like Samantha Power, for example, like John Kerry, like Susan Rice, who are perhaps a little bit more to the left of the Democratic Party than perhaps, say, Hillary Clinton might have been.
You say this is something that might have arrived in the second term, but I was just wondering that as the United States increasingly gets a reputation for being a nation unwilling to embark on whole-scale conflict abroad, mm-hmm. It's not unafraid to jump in and do a job when it sees fit. I mean, I'm just thinking of the Osama bin Laden raid. Mm-hmm. Exactly the same methods were deployed there.
Yeah, and I think with regard to that, that's an interesting development. But I think that what you're seeing there was less an attempt. I don't think anybody expected bin Laden to be coming out of there alive.
No.
I think too many questions might have been asked that might have been a bit too sensitive. But here there seems to have been a discernible attempt to go in and snatch and bring back to stand trial, for example. And of course, one of the great debates in the Bush era was, should you treat terrorists as terrorists or as, you know, people to stand trial? And there appears to be a legal shift away from that Bush era mandate effectively towards a more Obama-esque approach. And again, more akin to what Clinton used to do, for example, which was, you know, render them to the US for justice, for example.
And of course, some tough questions already being raised by the questions where these incidents have been taking place. The Libyan government asking some very serious questions as to why they entered the Libyan airspace and entered Libyan territory.
Absolutely. It's quite interesting, isn't it? We've got a Libyan government who perhaps wouldn't be in power if it wasn't for American and foreign intervention in the first place, now asking about issues to do with sovereignty. And of course, you know, we've seen this time and time again when the US goes in to snatch anybody. I mean, Emma, you talked earlier on about bin Laden, of course, that was an incursion into Pakistani airspace. So the question of where international law resides, are these people beyond the law? Have they put themselves beyond recourse to international law by committing the crimes they have? We could argue this all day, perhaps.
We could, because we're looking at the raid that took place in Tripoli against Anas al-Libi. He is already under indictment for participating in the 1998 attacks on the US embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. Libya, on the other hand, has said, we will try him here. And you know, Libya have also been quite, they've always said, we will try the Gaddafi family mm-hmm. brothers, we'll try them in Libya. At what point do the Americans say, actually, he's under indictment, under American law, he's ours? Or do you think he's out already?
He's certainly not in Libya anymore. No. let's be honest about it. This guy is currently residing at the pleasure of the United States, almost certainly on a military vessel in the Mediterranean.
Air. We suspect he might be in the air.
In the air, perhaps. Okay, fair enough. Your data's a little ahead of mine. Not but really. This idea is certainly he's no longer going to be a Libyan problem, I think. I think he's going to be Uncle Sam's issue.
To what degree does it become an international problem, then? You said he's not a Libyan problem, but where do you start to draw lines about who has the right to try who where?
I think that with regard to this, the United States will say, hang about a second, we have dibs on him first. This is someone who we've wanted since the mid-1990s, again, going back to when Clinton was in office. We're going back a long time now. There is a jurisdiction issue here. And again, this comes back to the original concept about why rendition came in the first place. People who were wanted in country A for a crime had fled to country B where they weren't guilty of anything. So you take individual from country B, take him to country A where he is wanted, and then you stand him trial effectively. And that's what the US will say we're doing. He's a wanted man. We've got him. We're going to put him under indictment and give him all the full recourse of American law, something he might not necessarily get in his home country.
And James, let's shift our focus now to the United States domestic policies. The government shutdown continues. We're fast approaching that October 17th deadline of the U.S. debt ceiling. It really seems to be a showdown between President Obama and Senator Ted Cruz, one of the leading figures in the Tea Party movement, who essentially is refusing to budge.
To some degree, but I think the president's problems are less with the Senate and more with the House, to be quite honest, because the Senate will basically pass pretty much whatever it is that the administration wants. But the House of Representatives, of course, a very different situation. I think Speaker Boehner's coming out of this in a very, very difficult position. When we were talking at the beginning of the year about the fiscal cliff situation, I wondered whether Boehner would retain his job moving into the new Congress because he'd not really handled that very well. He managed to just about cling on to that. One wonders whether he will manage to do so moving forward, because there's no doubt, I think, that as the polling starts to come in, the Republicans are going to come out this very, very poorly. I don't think it's either side is coming out particularly well, but the latest figures I'm seeing certainly suggest that whilst the Tea Party candidates are probably going to hold on to their seats just because of the electoral math within their district, this could have a severe impact upon more moderate Republicans moving into the 2014 midterms.
Well, just some of that latest polling over the weekend shows that the Republicans could potentially, and it looks like, according to the latest polling, lose control of the House in 2014. Is that a real possibility here?
Congratulations, you walked right off my next line. Absolutely. Yes, that was my next line. I think it's a distinct possibility. If you look at this, you look at where the electoral math is working out. Of course, every member of the House of Representatives is up for re-election, a third of the Senate. So the idea that Boehner could be losing his speakership come what may, effectively, is a distinct possibility. But before we get to that, we've got to try and get, you know, a new continuing resolution. We've got to figure out what's going to happen about the debt ceiling. You know, do we want to raise it up towards $17 trillion?
And if you're going to bed on the West Coast of America or just being preparing to wake up on the East Coast, ready to start your Monday morning, day seven of the government shutdown, to what degree is the shutdown now spreading to areas outside government? We've read about Lockheed Martin, which are the, you know, defence contractors. Are people beginning to feel the pinch yet?
I think it will start to impact individuals because, of course, defence contractors will be sort of said, well, OK, fair enough, the government's not working, we're not putting things into effect at this point. There's two sides to this story, I think, Emma, which are quite interesting. One, you get the idea that government contractors are going to be impacted by this, federal employees are going to be impacted by this. Bad news. But of course, if you're advocating what the Tea Party are doing, the Tea Party will say the flip side of that is if you implement Obamacare, it's going to start impacting an awful lot of mom and pop individuals and organizations and businesses who cannot afford to implement the healthcare regime that the administration wants to bring about. So it's kind of like a lose-lose situation, depending upon which side of the political fence you're on at this point.
And now there is even some news that the GOP are also considering a potential six-week extension to fund the government and to come up with some deal with this debt ceiling over the next 6 weeks. So I guess just wait and see. But let's move on finally, James, to President Rouhani. A bit of a charm offensive to the West. And it seems like it potentially could be working, and it may be ruffling a few feathers, especially when it comes to Benjamin Netanyahu.
Absolutely. You know, I keep thinking back to the 1980s when you had Reagan and Gorbachev at the end of the Cold War, and Gorbachev making very, very effective use of the media, being more popular, arguably, in Europe than Reagan was at that point. We've seen him come to the United Nations recently, Rouhani, of course, not Gorbachev, and talk about this new rapprochement effectively with the West. There's no doubt that this is getting under the skin of Bibi Netanyahu. He has had private meetings with President Obama, almost warning him not to be taken in. He's now taken to the American airwaves. He was on CBS's Face the Nation this weekend, basically saying, don't be gullible. Netanyahu's a very smart political operator, whatever one believes about him. The fact that he's made this address in English as opposed to speaking back in Israel, where we wouldn't probably be talking about this, very much addressing his constituency as he sees it on Capitol Hill, you know, trying to deliver a broadside, I think, against the Obama administration. The same week, of course, that the Syrians begin dismantling and disarming their chemical weapons, he is saying, right, we stuck to the hard line with Syria, we've got a result, now we must do the same with Israel.
James, thank you very much indeed. That was Dr. James Boyes from King's College London.
Coming up, we'll be heading to Egypt, where violence continues to escalate, and we'll also be checking in with our Madrid correspondent in a moment. Stay tuned.
The Nobel Prizes, the world's highest accolade for scientists, economists, writers, and those who promote peace around the world. As the Nobel committees in Stockholm and Oslo prepare to announce this year's laureates, Monocle 24 takes an in-depth look at the prizes founded by industrialist Alfred Nobel in 1895. We'll speak to previous winners, go behind the scenes of the ceremonies themselves, and speak to those who believe today's awards have strayed far from Alfred Nobel's original vision.
They spat in the face of Nobel on the same week as they had received the prize.
That's the Nobel Prizes, a series of special reports, all this week on The Globalist and The Globalist Asia, right here on Monocle 24.
Oyuna, Comme des Garçons, Armadillo, Porter. The Monocle shops feature carefully curated collections from brands around the world, consisting of unique and exclusive collaborations with Monocle's designers and editors, as well as every issue of Monocle, right back to issue one. Hong Kong, London, New York and Toronto, the Monocle shops cover all your travel, home, sartorial and reading needs. Go to monocle.com/shop to explore more.
Welcome back to Midori House. The time is 9:17 in Cairo. It is 8:17 here in London. Now, more than 50 people have died in fresh violence in the Egyptian capital of Cairo. The clashes were between the police and supporters of the ousted Muslim Brotherhood Party.
It's now a little over 3 months since the Brotherhood and their leader Mohamed Morsi were removed from power by the military, who have since arrested Mr. Morsi and charged him with inciting murder and violence. The country, it seems, is more divided than ever. Let's get the latest from our man in Cairo, Abdelrahman Hussein. Abdel, welcome as ever to the programme. Tell us a little bit more. Bring us up to date with this violence, about this violence yesterday. It was supposed to be a day of national unity.
Well, what happened was that supporters of President Morsi had announced that they would be marching and attempting to reach Tahrir Square on the day of a celebration. Meanwhile, the military and the interim government that it backs had called for people to come down to Tahrir to celebrate the day. And so what happened was that there were many marches from Morsi supporters all over Cairo and also in other areas of Egypt. And the marches in Cairo attempted to reach Tahrir Square, where they were met with heavy resistance by police and military forces. Clashes broke out in many several locations between 2 to 3 kilometers from Tahrir Square in two or three different directions. And these clashes resulted in 51 casualties and over 400 people arrested. And it was a day that, in stark contrast to what the Egyptian media was trying to present, it's not a day of unity. It was rather a day of severe polarization and violence.
And, of course, yesterday was meant to mark a celebration of Egypt's military. We saw some protesters chanting things like Sisi is a killer. What is the view of the Egyptian military since this this coup took place? Are they still viewed relatively in high regard?
I would have to say for the large part, yes, they are still viewed as high regard. They've been very successful in propagating their narrative that supporters of Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood are terrorists, and this is a war against terrorism, that removing Morsi was vital to ensuring Egypt's national security, and that the violence since then only proves this point. And so for the most part, they've been successful in this, and there are even calls for Sisi to become the president, and there's this campaign, they're beginning a signature campaign, collecting signatures to try and force Sisi's hand and have him run for president in the next election.
Abdel, which is worse on a day-to-day basis, Egypt under Mubarak, under Morsi, or under the military?
It's a difficult one. I think they're all equally difficult, but in different ways. What happened since Morsi has been ousted, although Morsi was in some ways an autocratic ruler and things were quite bad under him, there's also, but currently Egypt is under curfew, emergency law has been reinstated, and I think the military seems to be quite happy to have this aura and sense of control over the country.
Abdel, why isn't more being done to engage the Muslim Brotherhood and I guess, previous factions of the Muslim Brotherhood?
Well, like I said, this is the way this has been framed, and to justify removing Morsi and subsequent justification of violently dispersing the two Muslim Brotherhood sit-ins on August 14th, which was the single highest day of death in modern Egyptian history, and with the help of the majority of the Egyptian media, the military have been able to frame the events in such a way that have basically marginalized Islamist supporters in Egypt and painted them all as within this paradigm of terrorism, and this has been very successful. And I think for up till now, I mean, you do get a sense in Egypt that 3 years after the ouster of Mubarak and all the ensuing sort of chaos that has occurred since then, that people do pine for some sense of control and some sense of order to be reestablished. And the military has provided that, even though there's a lot of blood on its hands as well.
Abdel, you mentioned there that the Egyptian media is helping to disperse the military's message. The world has turned its attention away from Egypt. It was firmly focused on it about 3 months ago when Morsi was kicked out. To what degree is there any kind of freedom of expression, or did average Egyptians feel that their point of view is being put across?
Well, it's also very difficult to define. I mean, dissenting voices few and far between. I do admit that there is a large groundswell of support for the military, but anyone who publicly speaks against what's happening or publicly speaks against the level of violence that Egypt has seen in the past 3 months is often painted as a fifth column traitor, moved by foreign plots to destabilize the country. There's a huge nationalist upsurge right now in Egypt, and so that's sweeping up a lot of people.
Abdel, we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately, but many thanks for joining us on the program. Abdel Rahman Hussein in Cairo. You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson. It is 16:23 in Tokyo, 8:23 here in London, and in Madrid, it is 9:23. Well, it's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world, and today we're going to be heading to Madrid. That's where our Liam Aldis is. Liam, welcome to the show. Where should we begin today?
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about the shady past. So The United Nations Working Group on Enforced or Involuntary Disappearances, that's a bit of a mouthful, but they were here in Madrid just a week ago, and they met with 100 victims of the civil war and the Franco dictatorship, and they've handed down a very kind of damning report on the way the Spanish government has really dealt with their past, and they've called on the government to take on more responsibility regarding these victims. So there's been a lot of disappeared that haven't really been dealt with, and the government doesn't really want to get involved in the digging up of mass graves. And so they've called on the government to draw up a national plan to search for the missing and to revoke the 1977 amnesty law, which has basically been the foundation for the Spanish transition into democracy, and it's a big call.
How big a problem do the Spanish have with confronting the past? I mean, you read about judges not wanting to go to visit the mass graves when they're found, and the Spanish being very eager to help other countries examine their past, but the Spanish just seem to be unable to do it in their own home.
Yeah, exactly. It has kind of been glossed over over the last 3 decades, but mainly because there was this consensus to really just put the past behind them after Franco died. But the interesting thing with the Spanish transition or the dictatorship is that the dictator wasn't overthrown. He died, and so the country basically was forced into a democratic transition, but then they didn't really deal with the past because didn't really clean out the system. If you look at Franco's family, his daughter still lives in a lap of luxury. She still enjoys all the wealth that was pillaged from the Spanish people, and they haven't been prosecuted. So a lot of those people still kind of remain in the system, even though they have transitioned into democratic parties. So there hasn't been this grand consensus to deal with it, and if you look at the recent news, the PP party actually has a bit of a problem on its hands because a lot of its members have been posing on social media with Franco symbols and kind of Nazi salutes, and there isn't this big there's not this big effort to punish these people, and there have been a few PP party officials coming out and criticizing them, but then they still retain their posts. And all of this comes from mayors in regional towns who sing the Franco anthem, and there's kind of a big problem that they need to deal with, but there's no real effort to do it.
Why is Prime Minister Rajoy and members of his PP party just not doing more to tackle this issue, especially when it comes to, as you mentioned, those images that we're seeing of members of their own party on the far right, which are, you know, being photographed with fascist flags, posing with the far right salute?
Yeah, it is interesting. There's an effort in the leadership in the PP party to deal with it, but there was in the last government, in the socialist government, a 2007 historical memory law that basically ordered all the Franco symbols that remain in city councils and statues to be torn down. But since the PP party came into government, they've basically stopped funding this law and basically claiming that the crisis has deprived them of funds. But the United Nations Working Group actually called for them to say that this law had a limited reach and that the PP party should fund it, even though there are limited funds. It's a priority. So they actually even called for the Valley of the Fallen, which is a place outside of Madrid where Franco is actually buried, to convert that away from a mausoleum and turn it into a national memorial, and said that the Franco's body should actually be taken away from there. It's very strange that a dictator is still laid out in a national monument, and he's there for people to go and celebrate in a way.
How much has he actually spoken about? I mean, you mentioned the idea of, you know, swastikas and nationalist symbols now being sold by, you know, sort of almost without being noticed in state schools in Madrid. Do people actually talk about it?
Well, some people do. It depends who you talk to. Some people don't want to talk about it, and then when the other side of politics force it into the conversation, even when Baltasar Garzón, the famous High Court judge, actually initiated legal proceedings in the High Court to really deal with the past, he was eventually forced out of the High Court and banned from actually practicing, even though that was to do with another case. A lot of people perceive that as punishment for his effort to really bring that into the national conversation. So obviously it depends who you talk to. And when a lot of the left side of politics force it into the conversation. The right side of politics then talk about the Spanish Republic, which was in the 1930s, and start talking about all the victims that were in the 1930s because of the Spanish Republic. So it's this kind of tit for tat debate that doesn't really get us anywhere.
And Liam, I've got to admit, I was over in Spain a couple times this summer, but Madrid was not on my list, unfortunately. But it seems like that is a problem that I am not the only one dealing with. Lots of people not going to Spain, Barcelona overtaking Madrid when it comes to passenger numbers at the airport, and just some more worrying concerns there from the city council.
Yeah, I was very disappointed that you didn't stop by Madrid, Phil, I have to say. But it is a problem. There's a lot of problems in Madrid at the moment, and there's this growing, this groundswell of anger, if you will. Before it was kind of frustration, now it's anger on the streets of Madrid that the public administration really isn't doing enough to improve the city. It seemed they had a lot of their eggs in the one basket, the Olympic basket, and now that we didn't win the Olympics, a lot of people are shifting their focus to the city council and just really blaming the leadership or the lack of leadership. We have a debt of 7.4 billion euros. Foreign visitors, like you said, were down in August by 22%, and if you look at there was a rise in visitors to Spain in that month, but we dropped 22%, which is really crushing. And if you look at some of the way the streets are, if you just take a walk through the streets, street repairs have been cut, or the budget has been cut from 310 million euros to 167 million euros, and you really notice it on the ground. But there's a whole lot of things. The jazz festival that's been going for 30 years actually has been forced to cancel this year because the city council refused to grant them access to some of the theaters, and they're not really making an effort to promote the city. There's a lack of a brand. And even Ana Botella, who made headlines with her famous Café con Leche speech in English at the IOC, received criticism last week as well when a delegation from India gave a statue to the city council, and the Indian diplomat passed the word gave the podium to Ana Botella, and she came up and she wasn't actually expecting to give a speech and just said in Spanish, thank you for this statue, thanks a lot, and then sat down. So a lot of people are questioning her ability to lead.
Liam, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. In the next half hour of today's programme, we meet the film critic the British call the Good Doctor. But first, with the time at 31 minutes past the hour, Barney has the latest.
Thanks, Emma. Up to six people, including four police officers, are reported to have been killed in a bomb attack which targeted anti-polio campaigners in Pakistan. The victims were in a van which was part of an anti-polio campaign in the northwestern city of Peshawar. At least 50 people have been killed in violent clashes between Egyptian security forces and supporters of the ousted President Mohamed Morsi. Most of the deaths were in Cairo, where 200 members of the Muslim Brotherhood were arrested. Secretary of State John Kerry says the US and Russia have agreed to press the United Nations to set a date for a Syria peace conference sometime in the second week of November. Mr. Kerry also had some praise for Damascus for their compliance with the UN Security Council resolution over Syria's chemical weapons. U.S. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew has warned that the ongoing government shutdown is harming the economy. He said politics in Washington could seriously damage the economic recovery unless the situation's resolved quickly. Greek and international anti-fascist activists have attended a memorial rally for the left-wing rapper stabbed to death in Athens by a supporter of the far-right Golden Dawn Party. They say they want the party leader and other members to stay in jail for justice to be served. And Airbus has announced its first jet order from Japan Airlines. The $9.5 billion landmark deal for 31 wide-body A350 jets follows an intense battle with Boeing, as Japan's two top carriers seek dozens of new long-haul planes over the next decade. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Barney. Barney will be back in a little under half an hour to bring us a full roundup of what's going on in the world, after which point you can hear The Urbanist here on Monocle 24, our programme dedicated to the cities we live in. In the meantime, you're back with Midori House with me, Emma Nelson, and Phil Hahn. We turn to the very specific world of the film critic, down to the stairs, to a Soho basement for a lunchtime screening of This, That, The Other, The Great, The Good, The Usual Suspects, dust playing in the projector beam, trying to make notes in the dark, air-conditioned air. Sounds
rather dubious.
Oh, it sounds great. And then get me there.
Then apparently that's when the magic or the tragic starts and is judged, thank God for us, so we know what might make our evenings. Well, Mark Kermode, the UK's most recognisable movie critic, his empirical styles earned him the nickname The Good Doctor.
And he has a great quiff.
He has a what? A great quiff.
A really good quiff.
I'm not familiar with his hairstyle.
Quiffy.
I'll have to look, yeah. Well, his new book, Hatchet Job, lets light in upon the magic of the critic's universe in a timely fashion, asking what the role of the critic is now. Everyone can voice their opinion on the internet. Well, our news editor, Tom Edwards, went to the good doctor.
People really like a good, scathing, pithy, mean-spirited, funny put-down. All those things like, you know, vampires suck, this movie sucks more, Battleship, miss. All those sort of things people remember. And I remember my friend John Norton, who described The Postman as post-apocalyptic Pat. And I just carried that around in my head for ages when I sat down to watch Forrest Gump. David Cox, this is how I begin the book. David Cox, a very good friend of mine, works at Film 4, literally leaned over towards me just as the house lights went down and whispered the words Forrest Gump on a tractor. And the movie was finished as a result of it. It is harder in the end to praise movies than it is to damn them. And if you just fall into the, you know, just being snarky about movies, firstly, you save yourself from any risk, because there's no risk involved in being rude about films. You can be rude about films all, you know, it doesn't matter whether people like the films or not. I mean, that's the really strange thing. People can be rude about a film you like and you still find it funny. But if somebody stands up for a film you hate, it's a strange
thing.
Issue.
Yeah. So, let's talk about a bit about the sort of broader than the critical faculties, because
sounds like an arts department in a university.
Well, I do my best. There's a sort of a recurring theme almost in the book about the changes of technology. You write about, you know, your first forays into using a fax machine.
Oh, quite Lord, yeah.
But I mean, now we've got the internet. It's good and bad. Obviously, people talk about it. This idea of the citizen journalist. Everyone's a critic. Mm-hmm. There's obviously a bit of a debate about this. As a recognised critic, an established critic, someone whose views people tend to actually pay attention to, how do you feel about this idea that now movies are promoted with, you know, Twitter quotes and this kind of nonsense? You write about it a bit in the book.
Sure.
But I mean, it's a problem, isn't it? It's not edited. There's no real sense of where these people are coming from. Is it a wholly bad development that everyone can have a view and get it out there?
There's been this phenomenon recently of Twitter quotes appearing on movies. You know, the best movie I've ever seen, Sheena from Pudsey. And Andrew Collins wrote in the Radio Times about this. He said, there's no suggestion that Sheena from Pudsey is making it up. The question is, who is she and what else has she seen? If somebody says, this is the best film I've seen all year, my first question is, okay, what else did you see this year? And if the answer is nothing at all, then okay, of course it's the best film you've seen this year. It's happened as part of a wider trend, which is this idea that somehow film critics are snobby and elitist, and they only like the films that real people don't like. And real people like different things, and what you actually want is real people telling other real people what they really like. There's certain things to do with being a film critic that are really unchangeable, which is you have to understand what is the film, who made it, where does it come from, what other films does it relate to, just the basic factual structure. Okay, and that's a discipline, and that's learnt simply through doing the work at the coalface. Why is it that Philip French was the greatest film critic in the English language? He'd been doing it for 50 years. You see that many films, you have a frame of reference that means when you see a new film, you go, okay, well, it's interesting because it relates to that Western that you probably didn't see and that Japanese movie, which you may well have seen. And incidentally, there's a better version of it that's currently being made in, you know, that. Okay. So the factual stuff is important. But more important even than that is, what do you have invested in this opinion? Who are you? What else have you seen? And what have you got to lose by saying it? That's my problem with Twitter quotes, is anyone can say anything. And to quote Andrew Collins, who's to know? Anonymity is the scourge of all criticism. The only opinions I'm interested in are opinions to which somebody will put their name. And I need to know, who are you? What have you seen? What, you know, what's your history and what have you got to lose by saying this? And if the answer to those is I don't know and I don't care, then I'm really not interested in what you're saying.
Let's talk a little bit about, I mean, it's called Hatchet Job, the book. It's basically also about bad movies, ultimately. I just wondered, in terms of some of your favourite serial offenders, if you like, what's your view? I just wonder what your real view of someone like Michael Bay, there's always these jokes about him. Is it possible to make so many bad movies if you're just a bad director? Or is there some kind of warped genius that can deliver something so unappetizing and so infuriating to you? You must have a sense of almost admiration, don't you, for your sort of serial offenders?
Everyone thinks that what I want to do is go on hating Michael Bay forever. Okay, I don't want to hate Michael Bay's. Incidentally, I've never met Michael Bay. I'm talking about his work. I have no idea what he's like as a person. I know other people who've worked with images, but that's a whole different thing, right? Just saying the same things over and over again becomes very boring. And there was a weird moment in the case of Pain and Gain when, you know, there was this story that Michael Bay had made an art movie and it was, you know, low budget for him. It's like $30 million or whatever it is. And Mark Wahlberg, who I like very much, and it's based on a real story and it's going to be like a blackly grim kind of, you know, people were talking about Elmore Leonard and, you know, all this sort of stuff. And I thought, great, I'm going to, you know, how interesting to see a Michael Bay film that's going to be good. And of course, it had happened before with Guy Ritchie, who had made some terrible films and then made the Sherlock Holmes movies, which I really like. And I went in and I sat down and I swear nobody believes me. I swear I went into Pain and Gain with an open mind. I wanted to love it. I wanted it to be different. I wanted it to be great. And I was going, okay. 5 minutes in, it was like, oh no, this is hell. This is, he has done that classic thing of he has opened a window on his soul and it is a gaping abyss of black horror. I do believe that if you're a film critic, you only know what good looks like if you know what bad looks like, you know. And so any idiot can go along and watch Schindler's List and realize that it's important. But it takes a special kind of idiot to realize that Cannibal Women in the Avocado Jungle of Death is important. And, you know, and it is incidentally important. And, you know, Kim Newman always said, he said there's virtually no film he's ever seen that he wished he could unsee because it all adds to the body of knowledge. I mean, people say all the time, I saw Jurassic Park the other day. It was the worst film I've ever seen. No, it wasn't. You want to see the worst film you've ever seen? You come to my house. I will show you the worst film you've ever seen. Believe me, you will crawl out of the door at the end of it.
Well, that was a very passionate Mark Kermode there speaking to Tom Edwards for this week's edition of Culture. A little unfair, though, perhaps, on Michael Bay, the director who's behind films like Armageddon, Transformers, Pearl Harbor. You kind of know what you're getting if you watch one of those films, don't you think?
I know I'm getting not a trip to the cinema when he's directing it. Cannibal Women in the Avocado Jungle of Death, however, a completely different matter. And for anybody who's not aware of who Mark Kermode is, he is a British film critic. And if anybody has ever seen how unspoken he is. Look up his treatment of Sex and the City 2. It is something to be savoured. It is a 10-12 minute rant. And do it with a little bit of spare time if you have. It is really worth
watching.
It's
a good spectacle, isn't it?
It's a good spectacle. If you haven't got the time, look at the last 30 seconds. It tells you everything.
And of course, you can also hear the full interview on this tonight's show of Culture, which airs this evening at 1900 hours London time, 1400 hours if you're in Toronto.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this with a kickabout.
The perfect way to start the day on the East Coast or in Latin America, your lunchtime catch-up in Europe, The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced news and business show, bringing you up to speed with all the day's biggest stories.
It is absolutely vast. It's palatial in its proportions, this building, and it really reflects just how important the role of Mayor of Paris is.
Monocle's team of in-house experts bring you all the latest news on media and aviation, defence and technology, while an editor is on hand to run through the morning's front pages from Bogota to Boston.
You have all these people scrambling, you have all these investigators involved, and we still don't have a clear reason as to why these batteries did what they did.
My feeling is that politicians eat and try to enrich themselves and tax us.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York, in association with BlackBerry.
It's 8:42 a.m. here in London. Sport isn't one of our favourite topics here at Monocle, but there are some exceptions to that rule by all accounts. The British football star Dennis Bergkamp warrants such an exception, or at least a book, Stillness and Speed, the book about Bergkamp's art at kicking the ball, written by journalist David Winner.
Well, our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield caught up with Winner before we came on air.
We don't normally do football books and football autobiographies on Monocle 24. But this is a different kind of footballer and a different kind of book. We'll come on to the type of book it is in a moment.
Sure.
But first of all, Dennis Bergkamp, for those that don't know him, why should they?
He's one of the great artists and practitioners of the most important cultural form on the planet, which is football.
That's a decent enough answer. and he is one of those people that really transcends, you know, not just clubs. So if for example, I'm an Aston Villa fan, he played, you know, most of his career, or certainly the most successful part of his career at Arsenal.
Yes.
You know, I can still appreciate and love what he did. But he also, in a sense, does transcend the sport.
Yeah, he's it's from the general to the particular. you know, the more one focuses in on something, the more you realise it has a universal thing. This is beginning to sound quite pretentious, actually.
No, it's all right. We can do pretentious.
But, yeah, I mean, Dennis was an extraordinary artist in his chosen field. And because he was a great artist, you feel it, whatever, you know, you happen to be. You don't have to be interested in football to see, you know, video of him doing his great stuff to realise what he's doing is extraordinary.
And it's interesting as well, you know, reading his words. Footballers, again, are not necessarily known for being that expressive about anything, but particularly about the game that they play. It's very much sort of, well, we take each game as it comes. And, I'm very happy I scored, but the important thing is that we won, boss. Yeah, that sort of thing.
you obviously don't hang out with the smarter football.
No, but Dennis isn't like that. He talks about the game in a really fascinating way.
Yes. Well, the idea for the book, I mean, there's two books, actually. One in Dutch, which is much bigger, which is much more of a sort of conventional journey through his career, season by season, and exhaustive and very thorough and very good and loads of wonderful pictures. And for the English version, we wanted to do something very different. And it's often done with artists and architects and filmmakers and stuff, but nobody'd really done a book, partly because it just sort of, most players don't lend themselves to it. But a book about how a footballer approaches his craft, his art, the career is almost secondary. Yeah, he played for some big clubs and he won some stuff. But lots of players have played for big clubs and won stuff. What's interesting about Dennis is that the way he did it, his process, his process of change. Again, we're beginning to veer into kind of slightly tendentious areas almost, but it's very, very practical with him. So, for example, the way he learned to control a football and do really interesting things with a football. I always thought that because he came from Holland and his first coach at Ajax was the great Johan Cruyff, who was kind of the inventor of what we think of as total football and Dutch football. And you think, well, he's got to be the one who's taught him all this. Or if it wasn't him, it was Louis van Gaal, who was the next great manager at Ajax. Or it must have been somebody taught him. Like the painters of the Renaissance.
And actually, it's none of that at all.
He talks, it's very moving and it's so sort of simple. As a kid, he just loved kicking a ball against a wall. Anybody who's ever played football has done that.
Yes, but I didn't do it quite like this. I kicked a ball against a wall. I didn't, as he says, he thinks, well, if I hit that brick there, it bounces once. If I try and hit the brick above, will it bounce twice? If I hit it slightly softer, what will happen then to the ball?
And he's just fascinated by it. He's not obsessive. He's not, obsessive compulsive or something.
No.
He's not being driven by pushy parents or something. He's just loving doing it. And from that emerges a completely unique way of playing the football.
And one of the things I found interesting about this as well was that when he talks about how he learnt, because he's now a coach at Ajax.
Yeah, yeah.
And he talks about how everything is set up now that, the players know exactly, what time they have to be there. They're picked up, all the food's laid out. They're told specifically, all the coaches are very nice people now.
Yes.
They look after them, they get a nice rub down at the end. It's all fine. It's all sorted. And he thinks, well, actually, this isn't how I became a great footballer 20 or 30 years ago, because I was yelled at and no one really coached me properly in that way. But I learnt myself. And he worries that, and again, this is where I think it becomes something that's not just about football, but about, that there are broader lessons here.
Yeah.
He talks about how, are we teaching people in the way that we should be?
Well, it's all about, bringing out the fullest potential of somebody. So it doesn't matter if he's a kind of a great tackler and marker, like Martin Keown was at Arsenal, or he's a great, goal scorer, like Ian Wright was. Somebody who gets their maximum, fulfills their every potential. That's the kind of greatness that he likes.
He's now back at Ajax where he began as a coach. These things are obviously very hard to predict, but do you think he's got the makings of being, in the same way that Pep Guardiola and Johan Cruyff before him, that he's got the makings of being a great football coach and football manager?
I think he will be a great coach, but he's not going to be a manager because he doesn't fly.
Yes.
And he's, absolutely adamant on that. And he gets just quite cross if people say, yeah, but you can do a course, you can have therapies. He just, holds his hand at the stop right there. I'm not doing it. I've done lots of flying. I profoundly hate it. I found that I got very happy. For example, in his football career, when he came to Arsenal, he said, okay, I'm just not flying. You have to understand that. And they accepted it. But and then his career, his late career for the national Dutch team, he was lucky that the World Cup in 98 was in France and the Euro 2000 happened to be in Holland and Belgium. You know, that was a lucky break
that
for all of us, because he was great in both those tournaments. He's not going to change that, and people shouldn't ask him to and expect him to.
David Winner there talking about Dennis Bergkamp to Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield.
And now to warm up for our Brazilian newspaper review, let's listen to a Brazilian classic, which was number one in several countries around the world back in 1989. Now, this is, of course, at the request of our next guest, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. This is Camoa with Lambada.
Oh, no.
Was Kaoma with Lambada and some very nice moves by our very own Emma Nelson.
Oh, goodness, that was a very messy time. Right.
You loved it, right, Emma?
I hated it.
Oh, you lied.
You're describing that it was a sort of very stylish, very beautiful thing to dance to and how everybody was sort of throwing themselves around gracefully. If you were anywhere near the United Kingdom that summer, it was messy. It was very horrible. Anyway, you're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson and Phil Hahn. Time now to look at today's papers. Our focus is on the Brazilian press. You may have noticed from that song giving us a clue. Fernando Augusto Pacheco is here with us now. Faye, thank you very much for bringing us that terrible music. What's in the papers?
Well, shall we start with O Globo today? Let's talk about some politics. So last week was the last week that you could actually create a political party or join one if you wanted.
You have awful lot of them in Brazil,
don't
you?
We have 32, actually.
Right.
But actually, it's funny enough, one of the most important was about to be created, called Rede, or Network, translating, was the party that Marina Silva wanted to create. You know, she's the previous Green Party leader. She's doing very well in the polls at the moment. She's second only behind Dilma. But she didn't manage to get the signatures for her party. So basically, on Friday night, like over the weekend, she had to decide her political career if she wanted to be a presidential candidate for next year's elections. So she decided to join the PSB, which is the Brazilian Socialist Party. And she's probably going to be the vice president for Eduardo Campos, which is a very successful governor of Pernambuco. But that's quite interesting because actually she's doing much better than him in the polls. Mm. She has like around 22% and Eduardo Campos has around 8. So, I mean, I'm not sure actually what her supporters will think as well, because she was kind of the anti-politics candidate and now she's joined just a kind of a normal political party.
Does anyone actually believe that Dilma won't potentially win? Everyone still thinks she'll come away as the winner, right?
Well, she's the favorite, but now there's been a lot of columnists writing that now apparently there's a third way of Brazilian politics, because in the last 20 years, Brazil was governed either by the Workers' Party or by the center-right PSDB. But now with Eduardo Campos and Marina Silva together, they might create a new political party, a very strong one. And the only thing is they're kind of more center-left. So I think Dilma is not going to be happy with that because she's going to lose some votes to them. That's my opinion.
Let's move on to books. You were in Suffolk this week, the hideout of all Brazilians in the United Kingdom.
Exactly. Well,
what were you doing?
Brazil,
Suffolk.
I think it's a great combination.
They have beaches.
Yeah, they do. Well, beautiful ones, actually. I have to say, I love the English seaside.
Oh, God, with the north wind coming down from Siberia, you must be joking.
Yes, it was so hot, I almost went for a swim. But I decided not. I forgot my swimming trunks at home, so never mind.
So you weren't there just to go for a swim, were you, Faye? You were there for a professional reason. What was it?
Of course. So, basically we have a book festival in Brazil called Flip. It's the most important. And it was founded by a British woman, Liz Calder. She used to be the director of Bloomsbury here in the UK as well. And, you know, it's all in a beautiful city in Rio, called Paraty, you know, very wonderful city, very cultural, so a lot of festivals, including a very famous jazz festival as well. So she decided to do, for the first time, to do like a branch of Flip here in the UK. Excellent. In Suffolk. And it was such a nice vibe. And a lot of guests, very, very famous ones like Ian McEwan and Will Self were there as well, among other Brazilian authors and Brazilian musicians. Even there's some Brazilian food.
Excellent stuff. So, is this going to be in an upcoming edition of Culture?
There will be next week's Culture. You're going to be able to listen to some of the interviews, including with Alex Bellows as well.
Excellent stuff. So, and this, of course, coincides with the Frankfurt Book Fair and Brazil, the special guest at this year's event.
We are the special guest. We're sending 70 authors to the fair, and there will be 260 Brazilian titles there. And I have to say, 117 of them will be translated to German. But of course, there's always some controversy in everything, right? So the first controversy was the fact that the Süddeutsche Zeitung, they ran a piece saying that, accusing the Brazilian government of racism, because only one out of the 70 authors is black. And but of course, the government said that's not the case. You know, the government is not really in charge of selecting all the authors as well. I mean, it is a bit weird, but I don't know what to say about that. But then there was another controversy. Paulo Coelho, do you know Paulo Coelho?
Absolutely. Yeah.
He's the most successful Brazilian author. He was invited to go there, but he decided to boycott the fair because he said he disagreed with the list of authors. He said that, oh, I only know 20 of them. The other 50, I don't think they're professional. I'm sure they're there just because they're friends of friends. Well, I don't know. It sounds like a very self-important declaration, but I, you know what I mean. Paulo Coelho is always like that. He always like a funny...
His book, The Alchemist, isn't bad, though.
Yeah, exactly.
Very briefly, I think we have about 10 seconds to tell us. Men can now become... No, they can now take their wife's surnames. How do I say this? Faye, help.
They're adopting their wife's surnames.
Right.
And 25% of them are doing this, which is an increase of 342% in the last 10 years.
What does that say about Brazilian women?
They're becoming stronger and stronger.
Here we go.
Just look
again.
At our president.
Are we back onto the wrestling?
Wrestling.
Yeah. Back onto wrestling. The last time you were here, you accused me of looking like a lady wrestler. Thanks, Faye.
A pretty one.
Unfortunately, that's even better. Brilliant.
Unfortunately, though, that is all the time we have for today. Thanks to our producer, Daphne Denny, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, of course, and Harriet Thorpe. And our studio manager was Alex Funnell. Up next, after the news, is The Urbanist. And of course, stay tuned for the briefing at midday London time at 7 o'clock in the morning if you're listening to us from New York. I'll be back with Georgina Godwin for Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Emma Nelson.
Thanks very much for listening.
Bye-bye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.